Hello and welcome to a new edition of SNJ in Conversation. I'm Tanya Tiraoro, co-director of Special Needs Jungle, and my co-presenter today is one of our two new co-directors, Sharon Smith.
Hello, thank you, Tanya. So today is the first of a new series of podcasts where we are looking back at a decade following the Children and Families Act that received royal assent in 2014. So both Tanya and I were chairs of our local parent carer forums at the time, and we worked extensively on testing the reforms in one of the pathfinders.
So in the run-up to the reforms, one of the key figures in its inception is our guest today. Stephen Kingdom was Deputy Director of the Department for Education of Special Educational Needs. He helped lead the team writing the SEN Green Paper, pulling together the Children and Families Bill and the trials or pathfinders of the reforms. And in the years since then, Stephen has come over from the dark side of government and is now the campaigns manager for the Disabled Children's Partnership. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So looking back, Stephen, thinking back to 10 years ago, I remember that it was a time of a lot of hope, but also there were worries, there were concerns about the fact that there was quite a fundamental change being tested. So we saw the advent, obviously, of education, health and care plans, which were going from birth to 25, so bringing entitlements for a longer period of time. Bringing together education, health and social care with joint commissioning, but also into one document as well. It all sounds very ideal, putting children, families at the heart of the processes as well. But we know that it's not really turned out necessarily as intended. So, Stephen, can you take us back to 2012 to 2014, just after the Lamb Inquiry? How were these big ideas created and what was it like pulling it all together?
Well, I actually came in after the Green Paper was written, but before the plans were finalised. So I actually joined Special Educational Needs and Disability, having previously been working on school funding during the consultation period on the Green Paper. So a lot of the proposals were already, you know, embryonic by the time I came in. But there was a real, I think there was a real clarity of purpose at the time about trying to make children and families' lives better. I think there was some really clear evidence from the Lamb Inquiry, from various Ofsted inquiries, and from what, you know, parents and parent carers were telling the department. So I think there was a sense of optimism. I think during that period, sort of 2012 to 2014, there was also clearly a lot of scepticism out there about what the government's intentions were. And I think we found that you wrote anything down and people were trying to find, you know, some nefarious purpose. So we had to try and be very clear that we weren't taking away any existing rights and protections, and that the reforms were to build on that. And I think there was an understandable worry about pace of reform and about how those changes were happening. And in the wider context, which I think I'll come back to this a lot in this conversation, I suspect, the wider context of reforms to the school system more generally, academisation, changes to the curriculum, changes to assessment, massive reforms to the health service, the beginnings of austerity and the impact that had on local councils. So I think that kind of wider context, which in a way in our SEN bubble in the department, we were working away and being idealistic and optimistic, but we were kind of slightly, we're not ignoring that, but I think trying to plough on despite that. But I think when you look at why things haven't turned out in the way we all would have hoped, I think you need to look at that as well as the reforms themselves.
So this was the first time really parents had been given a seat at the table, as far as I'm aware. Do you remember any resistance from officials or local authorities to it? And how did it transform, in your opinion, the development of the reforms?
I think culturally, I don't think the resistance has stuck, but I think there's still some people who would rather have a meeting at which you talked about what you're going to do, and then you had a meeting with parents rather than proper co-production. And moving that to proper co-production, so parents were there from the start, and in those discussions was a difficult process. And I think then there's a difficult process for the parents engaged as well. And we see that sometimes with some of the reaction publicly to National Network of Parent Carer forums. When you're slightly inside the tent as a parent on that side, sometimes other parents who don't feel they've got their voices being heard as well can be suspicious. So I think it was a new way through for us as officials, but I think also for parents engaged. I hope it improved the reforms. I hope it means they covered the areas that mattered to parents. I always say that Section 19 of the Children and Families Act, that the part which says that in acting their duties, local authorities must have regard to parental wishes and so on, is the key part of the whole reforms. Everything after that is mere detail. If you properly do Section 19 at local and national level, actually, that those principles, you really are delivering for children and families.
Do you think so really how crucial was Ed Timpson to this? Because obviously his background and his empathy for parents really came across.
I think Ed was great. I mean, I think also before I get on to Ed, I'd say Sarah Teather, who was the minister at the start of the process, who wrote the Green, was the minister when the Green Paper was written, who wrote the Green Paper in that sense. She had a real commitment in this area. But I think Ed's family background and personal commitment did take things to another level. I actually think politically it helped to have a Conservative minister rather than a Lib Dem minister in the coalition, but that's probably a longer discussion. But I think Ed's personal commitment was clear. His willingness to get out and to talk to parents, or he really wanted to talk to parents, and I think that made a real difference. And I think, well, I don't think we've seen a children's minister like Ed since, and I think that's a and we've seen a lot.
Lot we
I mean,
have.
maybe some of them didn't have time to prove they were like Ed. I mean, but I think that's been significant in terms of the success or otherwise of the reforms.
You were just talking about the importance of co-production and obviously having that family voice. One of the things that we still don't really have is a clear definition of co-production or clear guidance really about what does co-production look like on the ground. Maybe at the DfE level, the national network and parent representatives were working in what could be considered co-production, but how well do you think that has actually fed down to being, in terms of on the ground decision making, putting families at the heart of decision making? And do you think that maybe having a definition for co-production might have helped rather than 10 years later, still not really, people not really being sure what it is or what it should look like?
I think a clearer definition would definitely help. I think the risk is co-production became one of those phrases that got bandied around rather than something meaningful. In terms of whether it's really happening on the ground, well, I think when you see tribunal cases going up and up, when you see parents, well, not winning is the wrong word, isn't it? But the tribunal finding in favour of parents 98% of the time, I don't think you can say co-production is working on the ground. Universally, at least. I'm sure there are pockets where there is good work. Sorry, I know there are pockets where there is good practice and good things happening. I think even more so in my job now, by definition, we see the bad news and the bad cases. So I don't want to be completely pessimistic. But yeah, co-production isn't happening in the way we would have envisaged or wanted.
You moved on soon after implementation day, in September 2014. But as a DfE insider, did you get any hints or have any ideas that maybe implementation wasn't going to go as well as intended? Maybe around some of the things that you've talked about, that wider context, austerity, the funding that might be needed to implement the reforms?
I don't know about hints at the time. I mean, we talked a lot. I remember talking to Tanya about it a lot of the time around culture change and the need for culture change and how that implementation works. And that's a harder thing to
Coming on to
measure, isn't it?
that.
That's a harder thing to measure. So I think a lot of that early implementation ended up focused on very sort of widgety things you could count rather than the kind of co-production sort of culture change that we wanted to see. So that was difficult. And I know there's always been concern, and there's definitely concern now about lack of accountability. But I think we, in setting up the sort of implementation plans at the time, were very keen not to just immediately start beating up local authorities, because we knew it would take time for them. And I know this is a phrase which will annoy some people, but at the time, we were talking about the reforms needing time to bed in. It certainly should have bedded in by 10 years later. But in those early days, it was that concern about how you hit that balance between being supportive to local authorities trying to make changes in difficult circumstances to getting punitive in accountability. And the other thing I'd say is the departmental culture then, in terms of implementation, was very hands-off. We were in the relatively early days still of Conservative-led government, and they very much wanted to work in a different way than the previous Labour governments under Blair and Brown, where implementation then had always been accompanied by big field forces who went out into local authorities and to schools and supported and either held people's hands or, hit people around the back of the head or whatever to make the change they wanted to see happen. And we really had to fight to get any sort of field force and the improvement teams out there, because that wasn't the culture in the department at the time. And we had to fight to get the Ofsted CQC inspections. There was resistance in the department from very well-known political advisors, for example, who took the view that Ofsted's role was getting, it wasn't about SEN this, it was a general principle view that Ofsted's role was getting too big and we shouldn't be giving more roles to Ofsted. So it was a real battle that Ed fought to get Ofsted and the Ofsted CQC inspections in. So there was a difficult, in putting in place everything you'd really want for, I would have really wanted for implementation, we were fighting against barriers, internal barriers of a different way of working from what they'd been in the previous Labour government.
Yeah, and in fact, it was 2 years before there was any implementation, and perhaps if that had been there earlier, some of the element of handholding and slapping around the back of the head might have helped a bit more, do you think?
Yeah, I think it might have done. I think the real difficulty when you talk about, and I'm not going to claim anything other than implementation has not gone as it should. When you look at that, it's very difficult to know what the counterfactual would have been for children and families if we just carried on with the 96 Act and statements and those arrangements. Especially, I mean, we had discussions again at the time, Tanya, didn't we, about speed of implementation, about whether when you've got NHS reforms going on, when you've got big reforms to the school system, is this the right time to be doing SEN reform, was sort of one of the discussions. But it always felt to me that it was the worst time to do it, except not doing it would be even worse, because if you're setting up new structures in the NHS, new structures in academy trusts and the school system, and SEN is not in there at all and not being prioritised. So at least we hoped doing the reform would push it up the priority order.
I think in retrospect that what else could you have done? It was do it then or risk not being able to do it. And I remember you saying that at the time, and actually I think that was in retrospect that was the right thing. But the 2019 Send inquiry that looked back at how it had gone so far after many complaints from parents. It noted, I'll read it here, the department did not need to preside serenely over chaos for 5 years to see that things were not quite going as planned. The distance between young people's lived experiences, their family struggles, and ministers' desks is just too far. Now, as we've said, you gave evidence at the inquiry, but of course you weren't there after 2014. But if you had been, at what point do you think should the DfE have become alarmed that that families were being failed by these reforms and all the work that had gone on to it? I mean, should that have, in your view, sparked alarm much sooner?
I think so. I think it's very difficult, and it's very easy for me to be exculpatory, and it was like fine when I left it in 2014, and then it sort of mucked up after that. And that's
I
both,
left it fine, you know.
yeah, exactly, yeah. And that's both not fair and not reasonable. And I don't know what I would have done had I stayed and been in that position. So it's, I'm certainly not going to criticize individual colleagues or colleagues in that way afterwards. But it does feel there should have been a point where it's, we should be past embedding now, or we should be seeing, improvements and change and how that's monitored. But I think one of the difficulties is again, where did SEN sit in the department? So when you're in the SEN team in the department, sometimes it could feel like you were sitting over there doing your bit and hopefully doing good, but the rest of the department was carrying on its own merry way separately. And actually, if you look at the reasons, some of the reasons why it's not working as it should, some of that's about what's happened in schools more generally. And that, I think, actually potentially part of what the select committee's criticism should have been, that the wider school reform system wasn't working for children with special educational needs, disabled children. And therefore, that was actually putting too much pressure on the reformed system to deliver, the reformed SEN system to deliver, because it was being asked to do more than it had been envisaged it would have to do, because more children were coming into it, because more children's needs weren't being met by the overall school system.
I do remember a meeting with Ofsted and a senior advisor, him saying, well, it's like turning a tanker. It can take a long time. But this was like several years after. And you think, how long does this tanker need to turn itself around before you start saying it's a bit like the Evergreen, it's got stuck, you know?
Well, I wonder if that is a good analogy, that the problem is you're trying to turn the tank around and then you realise the wider school system, the cuts to social care for disabled children, the problems in the health service, the lack of therapists, all of those kind of things were actually the walls of the canal preventing you turning the tank around, and suddenly you're stuck. So yeah, I don't know if I've overpushed that analogy, but I think it's not a bad one actually.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Maybe those walls actually became narrower, for
Definitely,
turning
definitely,
that around.
definitely.
So, obviously you've moved to the Disabled Children's Partnership. What have you learned whilst in that role about SEND and parents of disabled children and children who have special needs that maybe you didn't know or appreciate while you were at the DfE? And that you think that those who are still working in the department maybe should know now.
I think when you're in, actually, it comes a bit back to Tanya's earlier question. I think it was Tanya's about, how good are the department at listening to parents, and how good are local authorities listening to parents. And I think when you're in the department and you're hearing lots of different voices, sometimes you can be a bit sucked in by some of the voices which get parental blame, get parent blaming, and you don't really realise you are. And then when you hear it in this kind of role, when you're talking to parents day in, day out, and really getting more under the skin of their lives and their experiences, you actually start seeing, no, they're being gaslighted here. This is not, I still have sympathy for the challenges that local authorities face, particularly in their financial positions. But when you then start saying, turning that into blaming the parents, or saying these are we're dealing with problematic parents and consistent complainers and that kind of thing. And you actually, when you're in the department, maybe you sometimes sort of get some sympathy with those arguments when you're actually talking to the parents and realize, well, you'd be a bloody consistent complainer if this is how you were treated. I think your sympathies, which are always hopefully more skewed towards the parents, get better aligned in that sense.
So, do you think then that, I mean, obviously, we're talking about the fact the department aren't necessarily hearing the views of those parents and some really quite problematic situations that families are finding themselves in. And this question I'm about to ask is not at all a dig at the National Parent National Network of Parent Care Reforms at all. But do you think sometimes the parent voices that the department are hearing are maybe more sanitized, or the going through the official channels that they maybe aren't really, as you said, getting under the skin of what's happening on the ground.
I'm not sure. I think the national network's in a was always in a difficult position, and I think they are much more willing. The conversations they will have with the department behind closed doors are much more, sharper than it may look from the outside, if you see what I mean, because that's the nature of the relationship. But I do think it's important for the department to hear from the widest range of voices possible. And I think, I mean, actually now on this side as well, but I think I felt this when I was in government as well. If you're going to get change, you need sort of parents outside, almost outside the inner circle, shouting and making fuss and getting attention and raising issues up the agenda. And then you need parents inside who you can have a more detailed practical conversation about what practical steps can we take, and sometimes with a bit of honesty about within the constraints that government's under. So
Course.
I think you kind of need
Place for
both.
both. Well, we do like to think we try to do both at Special Needs Jungle when we can. But see, following on from this, now you've been on the other side now for a good few years. You've seen it, as you said, from both a government and a family perspective. It's quite a unique position, in fact. So if your roles had been flipped and you'd had the DfE role after the role that you had now, how would that knowledge have changed how you approached the reforms and the influence you were able to bring to bear?
I think it would have. I think now, I mean, it partly is about the role and partly is just about what we've all seen. I think I would have been wants implementation plans stronger and firmer earlier. Not that we weren't trying to have an implementation plan. I don't want to make it sound as though we just said we've written it and here you go, but really, really push that more. And I think how much power I would have had, but I would have liked to have seen what more we could have done in getting the conversations with other bits of the department. Because as I said, I think sometimes at that point, particularly, it sometimes felt like we were sitting there on the side of the angels, but it didn't really matter because we were whistling in the wind while the rest of the department did what the rest of the department was doing. And the speed of change on academisation, the speed of change on curriculum, was happening there. Whether if I'd moved the other way, I would have had any chance of changing that. And I'm sure the answer is actually no, given sort of where we were politically at that point. But I think that feels the big thing about how you stop SEN trying to make SEN mend where a system is failing one group of children, rather make the system as good as it can be for all children, and then have SEN do that little bit, system do that little bit extra that some children need. And it's worth saying, in recent conversations I've had with ex-colleagues and with officials, it does sound like the schools, the sort of mainstream schools bit of the department, by which I mean the schools bit rather than mainstream schools, the schools bit of the department is recognising that it needs to do more to support children with SEN, as it were, outside the SEN system. Now, how much that's just because, sometimes money is what drives things first, and with the high needs budget going through the roof, it's what do we do about it? But if they hopefully are, it's seen as a problem to the whole system rather than as SEN on the side, that's a positive.
Well, it's hard to ignore now. I mean, with the absenteeism that has got the attention, but they haven't really got the understanding of the reasons why. But I think that's, and I think the reforms have kind of started chipping away, but very, very slowly.
I think, I mean, the absenteeism is really interesting because I think that's a kind of real indicator above and beyond what's happening in the SEN system, that is the school system is really just not working for a significant and growing group of children. And if school is a hostile environment for children, which is it clearly is for a growing number of children, there's something fundamentally wrong with how it's operating.
Yeah, absolutely. So, creating the Act, going back to 2014, it would have been obviously was a massive achievement. But there would have been, we assume, compromises, things that you might have wanted to get through but didn't. Are there things that you now regret that you didn't manage to get through in 2014 in the Act?
I'm not sure regret because I think we possibly got as far as we were likely to, but it would have been good to have got more purchase on health and social care. It would have been good to have, you know, I mean, in an ideal world, you know, we still have a system. We have a system which says we have education, health, and care plans, and we have, you know, these three legs of the stool. But you know, it's still an it is still an education system. It is still education that gets you the plan. It is the rights to appeal, the you know, the guarantee of delivery is still stronger on education than it is on health or social care. And getting those more even would have been a great achievement. We made some late successes in that terms. The Section 42 duty on the health to deliver what's in a plan, albeit they've written it there and they can write whatever they like, but the fact that there is a duty to deliver it was a major achievement because we really had to fight to get that. And in fact, it was a change of Secretary of State and the Department of Health that got it through because the Andrew Anthony, because that would never have agreed to it, but actually the current Chancellor did, and that's something that I think we should be grateful to him. To him for, and that was a significant change. And you know, the tribunal trial on recommendations on health and social care, which I'm very proud to say was my was actually specifically a lot of things when you work in civil service, ideas kind of come in a kind of group way, but that's one I think I can personally say it was my idea as a kind of compromise because the sector and anyone looking at it logically from the outside would say, why can't you have the same appeal right for health and social care? But we were never going to get that through the Department of Health or through the social care bits of DfE. So it was pleasing to get that through, but it'd been lovely to have a properly even playing field across the three parts.
I mean, for us, one of the big things that we wrote about at the time, it was EHCPs for higher education, because it just made no sense to us where you can have it and earn money at the same time, but you can't have that protection in higher education. And I think that's has been a real disadvantage to lots of young people. And we had conversations at the time. Was it always a non-starter?
I think it probably was because I mean it was a different department then, and trying to get another department to change was probably part of it. And I think there was a feeling that if you got into higher education, that was an outcome out of the SEN system, and now you're into a new system. You know, it's part of that 19 to 25 bit, which was never supposed to be about all young people keeping a plan until they're 25, but it's about it's always supposed to be about more time to move on to your to the next stage, and if you're in university, you need that. I think there was a worry about how effective local authorities would be in delivering it, especially if you had young people moving away from their own area to go to higher education. And I think at that time, and I'm really not an expert on it, but there was a feeling that actually the support in higher education wasn't too was pretty good, and did we want to interfere with that? And bring in local authorities and complicate it and risk actually putting something which didn't work very well and throwing out something that was working well at the time. Now, from my pretty peripheral view of it since, it feels like whether that was true at the time, the support has probably gone downhill since. So I would say the case is probably stronger now than it was then, but that's not a very evidence-based assertion on my part.
It's something we are still banging the drum about, though. We
One
mentioned
department
it
now,
earlier.
Tanya. It was two different departments then. It's one department now, so it might be easier.
It's good to know. We mentioned it before, culture change, and how the lack of it within public bodies has really helped to derail the reforms, funding aside. And changing culture sounds really nebulous, doesn't it? But this reform really depended on hearts and minds changing, as well as structures. So, in retrospect, what could have been done by the DfE, or especially by as LA leaders were also looking at falling revenues at the same time, and then seeing this massive expense coming on the horizon. What else? Is there anything that could have been done? Because they're still working on it now, but we don't see exactly what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of observations rather than immediately what could have been done. I think one big thing is the amount of staff turnover in local authorities. When I first started working on FPN in 2011, my team knew who were the good people in local authorities, which ones you could talk to. I mean, parents might not always agree, but you still could have a conversation. You felt you get some understanding. And then within, 4 years later, they're pretty much all gone and everyone had moved around and you didn't know anyone anymore. And that's carried on. So trying to deliver a culture change and build up relationships, because that's what it's about, isn't it? And build up relationships when there's that level of turnover is really difficult. And then I think the bit we possibly got wrong in terms of implementation was the way the transfer of statements to education, health and care plans. And there was a lot of pressure at the time from the sector that and that there really should be a really rigorous transfer and a reassessment for every child and young person moving from a statement to an education, health and care plan. And I wonder if that was a mistake and we should have had a more graduated approach and sort of deem a statement to be an education, health and care plan and then use annual reviews to sort of edge them across and focus on culture change and focus on the new education, health and care plans. Because what the implementation, I mean, looking by that stage a bit from outside, but what the focus of implementation became a numbers game a bit, or quite a lot, I think, on how many statements did you change for education, health and care plans. And that became the focus rather than, are you actually changing the way you work with parents? Are you actually putting parents and children at the heart of the decision-making process? How are schools working with the local authority? Now we've got an academy trust. How's the health service properly brought in? Are your joint commissioning arrangements actually, worth the paper they're written on? Is your local offer worth the web page it's written on? And things like that. So I wonder if we focused on a, because it's easy to count, isn't it? You end up with a widget, you focus on the widget, you can say how well it's being implemented and you miss the culture change. So focus, I guess, in that sense, is what was missing.
What would you do now to change it, if you could?
That's a really a really good question and a really difficult question. I think, well, some of it comes to the big DCP ask. I think that something needs to be from the start. I'd have a clear minister across government for disabled children, who's got a clear responsibility about banging departments' heads together. I'd expect local authority, the clear reciprocal, similar arrangements at local level with clear responsibilities across health and education with somebody who is reporting in. So there is a real political lead and a real sense of somebody is owning this, so that children and families are seen as their lives in their entirety rather than getting this bit of a service from here and this bit of a service from there.
So we've now got the Send an AP improvement plan. We've got a whole new set of reforms being tested with the Send Change Programme. In this conversation that we've been having this afternoon, we've talked a lot about how maybe the context at the time was challenging. There was scepticism. Maybe from parents, maybe from professionals engaged in the system. There was worries about the pace of reform. Do you think that this is a big question as well, that we're in a better place now to be implementing reforms? Do you think that the department have learned from the past mistakes, the things that maybe could have been done better? Or are there new mistakes that are potentially going to be made? And bearing in mind, of course, we've got the potential of at some point in the next year, we've got a general election as well. So, yeah,
Plus, there's a
where are
turnover
we
of
heading?
staff in the DfE as well, just as there is in
Absolutely.
experience lost.
That is a big question, as you said, Sharon. I think it's an interesting period to be doing anything, isn't it? And I think, because of the political context, And I think there's some advantages to, I mean, it's not, they're not advantages that encourage speed, but there's advantages in that at the moment. I think the testing program isn't under the same pressure it might be to find solutions immediately for a government, existing government to put in. So maybe it can be a bit more of a genuine testing program in that sense, and find some interesting things out that can then be used along with the, the plethora of other evidence we've got to come up with reforms that really, really will make a difference. So that's the positive. I think in terms of the wider environment, no, it's a terrible time to be doing anything, because, public finances are in an appalling state. Local authorities are literally falling over. But as I said before, I do hear encouraging things about a more, it's not trying to solve, just trying to solve SEN on the side. I mean, my real concern when I read the Green Paper and the improvement plan as well was, if you talk about the overall narrative about making schools more inclusive, improving the support, earlier intervention, so that more children's needs are met without needing to go into the system, which itself would relieve pressure on the number of education, health and care plans, the number of children who, where parents were looking for a special school place. All of that, I know some people are concerned about some of that, but that is a basic, very high level overall narrative. Seem fine, but then when you got to the detail in the plan, how you make schools more inclusive and the system respond earlier was written in about three sentences, and then bits which actually would undermine key protections and key rights and protections in the Children and Families Act were given in great detail. So compulsory mediation, limited list of schools, national standards, which was an interesting one, because when I read it first of all I thought that sounds good, and then wiser people like Katrina Moore started telling me why it wasn't, and I could see exactly where they were coming from. So it depends what national standards are. So, yeah. So if we can move back to that that bit of the overarching narrative and really look at ways of making that deliver, because actually in the long run that's the only way to solve all the problems that are faced. But it's not a quick and easy fix, and it will cost more money in the short term, because while it may save money, you can't save that money. Yeah, you haven't saved that money yet. You save that money in the future, but you need to spend now to get in a position that you can save that in the future.
And indeed, if young people can become productive members of society, it does, repay that into the economy. But I don't think people, officials or politicians can make that connection because, again, it's quite a nebulous thing because you don't know
Yeah,
how much it will save.
we've tried to do that over the years in DCP, and I mean a lot of it talking about investment in social care for families of disabled children, but it's across all aspects of it. Yes, if you spend more now, I mean parents may be out of work who are having to give up their jobs at the moment, and that's more, more income for government. But as you say, particularly young people may be less dependent on benefits and so on in later life, and be more productive. But making that long-term spend to save case is really difficult. And even in the short term, I think one of the problems is with finances tight, every bit of the public sector sort of regresses to its core in what it spends on. And often the person who makes the saving from a wise spending decision isn't the person who made that wise spending decision. It falls on a different part of the system. And that's why the high needs budget is the bit that's gone through the roof, because it's the bit where, actually partly because of the strong and clear legal rights in the Children and Families Act, that's where, when everything else fails, the bit of the system which has to respond.
So, but in some respects, I mean, we're talking about inclusion as well, which is an integral part of it, but it's as far away now, it seems to me, as it was before 2014. So, on the one hand, the DfE says it wants more children mainstream, yet it isn't really doing anything structurally to fix accessibility issues, for example. And yet it is announcing things like new special free schools. Do you think it's actually possible to get proper inclusion? And to fix send, is it ever going to happen?
I don't know. I don't want to be a pessimist and say no, but it is very difficult, and it's a particularly difficult time at the moment. I think we've had periods of time over the last, 30, 40, or 40 years since, 45 years since the Warnock Review, where things have changed and things have got better. And then we've had times when things have got worse. And I think the overall trend has been better until maybe the last 4 or 5 years, but overall trend has been better. So I think hopefully that trend continues, but it is very difficult at the moment to see where that goes. And I think it does need more investment, and seeing more investment at the moment feels very difficult. And I think, yeah, I mean, you talk about social care, that system is fundamentally broken as well, for exactly the kind of reasons you say, that parents find themselves begging for support, and then finally support comes from a child protection angle because the parents have said they're failing their children. It's like, we're not failed our children, you failed us. We hope the Law Commission review may address some of those issues, but you can't do it without money attached to it as well.
So, if you suddenly found yourself in charge of Send at the DfE again, so you wake up tomorrow and you're back there, what do you think the most important lesson is that you have learned from being on the other side that you would take back with you?
I think the most important lesson is, well, the most important lesson from the other side is listen to parents, and then listen to parents again, and then listen to children and young people again. In terms of other lessons, it's you can't fix SEN just by fixing SEN. You can't just go, within this. So I would spend a lot more of my time talking to the rest of the department about what they were doing to make sure the children I was responsible for within the department were having their needs met, rather than, I mean, in a way, I bit me would go, we've got a system that if it was operating properly would be fine. And one of the reasons it's not operating properly is because too much strain is being put on it because the rest of the system isn't operating properly. So you get your house in order, and then we'll sort out the FEM bit afterwards.
Is there anything there that we've not touched on that you think really needs to be said?
As I said, I think the really difficult bit when you talk about how the reforms have gone is knowing what the counterfactual is. What would life have been like for disabled children, for children with SEN, for their parents, for their families, had we not done the reforms? And actually, I do think it would be worse. And I definitely think, I mean, I don't know if this is fair. I sometimes feel like the implementation reforms never went well, but it got off to a reasonable start, and then at some point, about 2018, it sort of went downhill for one reason or another, and then the pandemic's pushed it even further, but that's not the cause. So I think that sort of counterfactual, and what would that do? And the other thing I'd say is spend a lot of time reading things where people say, oh, the 2014 Act was well intentioned, but it was, it was never deliverable, and it was unreasonable. Well, actually, a lot of the legal rights aren't that significantly different. If you talk about what is the criteria for getting an EHDP versus what's the criteria for getting a statement? They're not that different from the system before. But the reason it wasn't that the 2014 Act was unrealistic, it was that implementation hasn't been done well enough. And as I say, a lot of that is about what's happening in the wider public sector.
And of course, it wasn't, they didn't really fund it from the birth to the 25 bit as well, I think was.
I think that's entirely fair. I think there was a sort of the previous learning disability assessment systems went up to 25. In some respects, the young people should have been included with the same. So there was a bit of an argument. Well, the money's already there, and if you haven't spent it, that's your fault. And that was a mistake. There should have been more money put in, particularly for the post-16 expansion, definitely.
Stephen Kingdom, thank you very much for joining us today. Please do subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening. And if you are able, please also consider a small donation to keep Special Needs Jungle's lights on. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks.
Thank you.